Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. What would it take if some say, "Oh, Joe, we really want you to run for president in 2020," you know, that or whatever, 2024? Is there something that you would feel like, okay, that's it?
I don't see that happening. I just don't.
Someone said to me, "The Oprah Winfrey Joe Kennedy ticket."
That's right. That might do it. Right. That might do it. Oprah's. If I could sail in as Oprah's VP. So Oprah, if you're listening, go for it.
Today's guest, Joe Kennedy, congressman from Massachusetts, whom I sat down with in his district office last week, the afternoon after he gave the official Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union. I was there in person the night of the speech in the auto shop of a technical school in Fall River at the south end of his district. In the room, I could see the black Mustang with its hood up that was positioned in the back of the shot behind his shoulder. I could not see, though, whatever was going on with the glare off his lips. He says it was too much chapstick, but as you'll hear, he also has a pretty clear argument of what it says about anyone who spends a lot of time focusing on that or making fun of him for it. Like usual for speeches like that, they gave the reporters a copy of the prepared text about 30 minutes before it started. It was simple, 5 pages, a pretty well-done version of uplifting, Obama-style, unifying rhetoric. The big promise was that in response to what he called the false choices being offered by President Trump and his administration, Democrats choose both. Okay, here's the problem. Democrats don't have any idea who to choose to lead the party or what they're even looking for. There's this whole angsty, what's our message debate going on constantly. But the truth is, what was Donald Trump's message? Make America great again? What does that mean specifically? What was Obama's? Hope? Change? Not exactly a 14-point plan. So since Joe Kennedy's the messenger that Democrats chose for themselves to go up against Trump on the State of the Union, I figured I should get myself to Massachusetts and get his take on the message and the messenger question. Please also check out the story I did up on the Politico website, going deeper on all this. It's a question I know we're going to keep getting into over the course of this year, and as we begin what's clearly going to be a long run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Maybe just because he's a Kennedy, there's an almost literary feeling to him. Starts out with being born a Kennedy, of course, and it's not just the name, but those just insanely strong Kennedy genes. He looks exactly like his grandfather, RFK, except for his bright red hair. The Stephen Colbert line was that he looks like the love child of Superman and Conan O'Brien. He met his wife in Elizabeth Warren's class at Harvard Law. He speaks fluent Spanish because, of course, he did Peace Corps in the Dominican Republic. Is he going to run for president? Well, of course, I asked him that, but not before we talked through a lot of other things, including what's it like to have people flip out around you just because of your last name, and being in history class, learning about people you know from family get-togethers. If you haven't subscribed, please make sure you hit that button now so you can get all the episodes coming up on a 2018 that continues to move in major and unexpected ways. And if you've subscribed but haven't rated us yet, please do that. Putting in those 5 stars, yes, 5 stars, you know you want to do it, really does help the algorithm for new people to find Off Message. Keep those emails coming to isaac@politico.com and follow me on Twitter @IsaacDover. Please like me on Facebook too. And now, my conversation with Joe Kennedy, straight from Newton, Massachusetts. So you gave a speech last night that was about the country sort of on the brink. And some of the response to it was, what's with the shiny parts on the side of his mouth?
Yep.
What does that tell you about where we are as a country?
It tells me first I should have used less chapstick, which is probably the first mistake. Look, I think easy for me to sit here and bemoan the political discourse. And I will do that. That being said, I think all of us bear, you know, some responsibility for that too. The core, I believe, of the remarks that I made, the message that I tried to send is, it is a fractured and divided country. There are undeniably a number of a sizable percentage of our population that steadfastly supports the president. People that don't support the president have to acknowledge that. I have some passionate beliefs. I articulated those that last night. I'm not a big fan of the administration and their policy decisions and the way that they've handled our government. That being said, I also respect the will of the voters. I acknowledge the fact that he got roughly 63 million votes, and that there's still a core percentage of Americans that stand by him. Those voices matter, and those voices count. So,
but when the conversation becomes at all like, did he have drool fangs? People are not paying attention to the issues, whether they agree with you or disagree with you on them.
So, yeah, look, again, on the one hand, disappointing. On the other hand, we kind of got to push through it. I would like to think that part of the message I tried to deliver last night was an important one. Easy to understand why people that I was criticizing would look for any way to deflect it. That's fine. That's expected. That doesn't change the fact that I think the critique has merit, and they can point out too much chapstick all they want. It doesn't mean that the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice isn't rolling back civil rights protections. It doesn't mean that an economic plan put forth by this administration is largely zero sum, that it is benefiting somebody at the expense of somebody else. It does not get away from the fact that the tone and the rhetoric that our president has used has continued to divide America. And it's not going to stop the fact that I think that's wrong. Yes, I will use less chapstick next time. I used less this morning on the interviews. I've been using less now. Lesson learned. I would like to think if I can learn that lesson that quickly, hopefully some of those folks that are criticizing can as well.
The more official response, that was like the Twitter peanut gallery, was the cool thing. The more official response was some combination of you're a white guy, you're a Massachusetts liberal, you're a dynastic politician.
So on the one hand, all of those things are more or less true. Dynastic politician, I might take some issue with. I've been there for 5 years. That is not quite a dynasty build.
Well, there's been
some other members of my family that have been there for quite a bit longer. And I'm proud of their contributions, and I'm proud for the values that they stood for and the people that they fought for. Now, all of that being said, and look, I acknowledge that it's a big country. It's a diverse country. There's different issues. We're in a time of identity politics, and that's certainly true. And I acknowledge that. Part of what I tried to point out last night, though, was that there's far more issues, opportunities, obstacles, challenges that unite those various identity groups than divide them. And I think this administration is exploiting those divisions to exercise their own political agenda. That might work in the short term. I've never seen that work in the long run in our country. It's just, if you want to be a big, diverse place that brings people from all over the world.
Because the people are here anyway, right?
Because people are here and they've come here and they've got diverse backgrounds. Look, there's big cultural differences in the country. It's a diverse country. It's a big country. It's a large landmass. The challenges that, yes, we face in downtown Boston or Manhattan or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco are somewhat different from rural Pennsylvania and Oklahoma and Texas, clearly. There's still an awful lot of things that unite the people that call those areas home. And so I think what I believe the responsibility of any politician is, Democrat or Republican, is to try to acknowledge the challenges that are confronting us, find those areas of commonality, build a coalition that can try to find a solution to that challenge. I don't see this president doing that. And until we get to a point where he is, I think that in the long run is to the detriment of our nation.
I understand why the Democratic leaders wanted you to give this speech. I think everybody would be surprised that anyone would agree to this flat, right? Right? So what happens? Does Nancy Pelosi give you a call and say like, hey, Joe, I got an idea for you?
No. Funny story. My recollection is correct. I think it was Monday. So we were in the midst of the government shutdown in Washington. And we had a caucus meeting, I believe it was Monday morning. And she said, I want to talk to you in the caucus meeting. I said, okay. And she said, well, not now, later. I said, okay.
Like getting called into the principal's office.
So we're getting there. We're on the floor, and I approached her and I said, you wanted to speak to me? She said, oh, yes, but not here. And so she walked off the floor, and we walked into the cloakroom. And she had a couple of staff members with her, and I kind of turned around and stopped. And she kept going. She said, no, we're going to my office. And I looked at them. I said, I'm the staff members. I was like, am I in trouble? And we walked into her office, and we got into to her office, which can be a reasonably long walk from the cloakroom there. It was wondering what was happening with every step. And then we got into her office, and then she kicked everybody else out. And at that point, I thought I was in real trouble. And then she extended the invitation, and I obviously was honored to do so, understanding that it's a tough spot, undeniably, right? Nobody doing that speech is going to be able to match the circumstance and the ceremony around the President of the United States.
And all the expectations from the opposing party of what are you going to do about it, right?
Right. And that's fine. So I and our team did our best to try to say, you're never going to match it. Nobody is. I don't care how articulate a speaker
you
are.
You had to have a crowd in front of you.
But you knew you had to do something different. So don't try to match it. Just do something different that you think is an environment that's going to send a message and be something that you're comfortable with. Look, there might be some compelling speakers out there that can hold a televised crowd for 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes. direct to camera without anybody else there.
I don't think that there is such.
Well, I'm certainly not one of them.
I mean, it's part of the reason why, like, Obama, who I think everybody would say is a pretty gifted speaker, would not do Oval Office addresses because they knew that he was really bad in that environment.
Well, I think almost anybody is. You can do it for 30 seconds. You can do it for 45 seconds. You know, I think unless you're kind of Robert De Niro or Al Pacino, it gets pretty tough.
Yeah.
I'm not either of them. So I figured that doing that type of address wasn't going to be playing to our strengths.
Yeah.
And there was a message there that I wanted to highlight and was made it an awful lot easier, candidly, after we found out, team informing, that I didn't have to do it from Washington, where Leader Pelosi's team said, hey, you've got some flexibility here. Where would you like to do it? And that obviously opened up a whole wide variety of possibilities. And I have a deep affinity for Diamond. We've done a number of...
The school where I did it.
So the school was spectacular.
Yeah.
Administration there, and they worked really hard to pull it together.
It was a pretty big event, you know, all pulled together.
Yeah. And so the issue with that... of course, was the school did an incredible job pulling it all together. Our team did an amazing job making sure every final detail was worked out. It meant that if I fell flat on my face, I didn't have anybody else to blame. So that's the hard part of having a great team around you.
So let's talk about the speech. The speech was about, like I said, the country on the brink, it felt to me. Like you're saying, there's something really wrong. Like we're in a really bad place. But at the same time, your point was that it goes beyond politics and partisanship. It's something bigger happening. But then you ended and said that America is hopeful, resilient, and enduring. Well, which one is it? Is America going to be okay in your mind? I mean, you're really troubled by what's happening.
I am really troubled by what's happening. The distinction that I would draw on that is I think you've got a government that is not living up to the values that our people expect out of our government. And so... are we on the brink? I don't think our country's on the brink because some of those stories that, and those examples that I pointed to, you've got a nation itself that still exhibits this strength of character every single day. You've got politicians that are exploiting those differences for cheap political
gain. Which one is it? If the country's in danger from the Trump administration, you know, then how serious is the problem? Because I think that would be something that some of the president's supporters have pointed, oh, well, Democrats say like everything's terrible and, you know, we're destroying things, but like things are humming along just fine.
So I would say, and maybe to try to draw this distinction, I don't think our government is living up to our values. I think they're exploiting differences across our society for cheap political gain. And I think that is dangerous for the overall success of our country. I think that the actual overall character and integrity of our nation is still... its core is still there. There's still people that are doing and choosing to do good, selfless acts every single day. What we need to do is have a government that is reflective of that character.
What impact does it have? I mean, right? Like that's, if both those things are true, you think President Trump is dangerous for America, basically, and what he's doing? Or
I think...
Where does the danger lead to?
So I think what you end up seeing is you have a government that tries to find these fissures within our society and exploit them and turn, whether it ends up being protests sponsored by athletes as a way of speaking out against criminal justice issues in our criminal justice system that are then exploited to say, you don't support the flag. The idea that those athletes don't support the flag is just wholly untrue. That's not what that protest was about. It was appropriated by the president to spin it around in a different way to juxtapose its actual true meaning. It's issues like that that I think are dangerous because it does start to pull the country apart.
So to where do you worry that we might be going?
I think that if the administration does not alter its course, that you're going to continue to see these tensions continue to boil up and boil over. And what I'm saying is I think our character and integrity of a nation is being tested, but I'm also seeing that pushback. You're seeing that pushback with the number of folks that showed up at those anniversary of the Women's March.
Yeah.
You saw them showing up at the Women's March. You saw them push back against attempts to totally redefine and gut the definition of healthcare in this country. You're seeing it on, you know, issues on civil rights and LGBT protection. You're seeing a pushback to what this administration is doing. So my message there is more, it is to our citizenry to say, look, you got to get and stay active and engaged. This is your nation and your government.
And if they don't, what happens?
Well, and your government isn't living up to that promise. Now, government, also snap out of it. Live up to what the lofty ideals that we all talk about in those hallowed halls and actually step up and do what we're supposed to do.
Let me give you an example. The march in Charlottesville, there are some people said that is a result of some of the things that have been uncorked by – the way that Donald Trump ran his campaign and the way that he has been going about his presidency. That was not an uncommon view of what happened. And so I guess on that, that was something you referenced in your speech that that day. Was that his fault? And is there more stuff like that that's coming? Where does this go?
Look, I don't think you can put all of the blame for what happened in Charlottesville at the feet of any one individual, including the president of the United States. Do I think he bears some responsibility in it? Yeah, absolutely. Do I think actions and statements and inactions over the course of the several months of a campaign and then leading up to Charlottesville gave an opportunity like that cover? Absolutely. Do I think that the president's response to that was a shameful abdication of his responsibility and values of this nation? Yes, I do. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than an either or, but I think the president, if he wants to try to be the leader that he attempted to articulate last night, a unifier of our nation, look, he has to recognize that he's got an awful lot of ground to make up. He's been in office for a year.
I mean, it feels like it's done, right? Like people, he is the person he is. We're not going to see a change, Donald Trump.
And
you can love it or leave it, right?
Right. So I don't think so. I hold out hope. It's not all that optimistic. But look, this is also coming from somebody that, 18 months ago didn't have a real political ideology and a couple of years ago was a Democrat. So he has shown an ability, even we've seen over the course of this last negotiations over immigration and DACA, where he has an ability to change a position almost by the minute. So does he still have an opportunity to try to reset this framework? Maybe. Do I think he'll actually take it? No, I don't.
The big angst among Democrats is, what's the message? What do we stand for as a party? Can't just be anti-Trump. But, if you look at the response that you did, I think if you look at a lot of other things that Democrats have been saying, Trump is so much of a clarifying force that being opposed to him does seem to put Democrats on board with a pretty specific set of things. So, in fact, being anti-Trump is being for some things. And do we overstate the need for some great message?
I think that the president and his administration have become, and I think part of this is deliberate, so vitriolic and so the passions around it politically are so hot that it unfortunately becomes a bit of a litmus test. And yes, without question, it galvanizes support amongst his supporters and opponents to him and crystallizes some of the support on the left. That being said, and Isaac, look, this is part of the kind of perhaps rosy romanticized view of what government should be and what our political leaders should be. We shouldn't lead this country by being a definition of what not. I think you're actually seeing some of that now. I haven't seen a clear articulation of domestic or foreign policy of this administration other than not Obama. It seems like anything that President Obama did, he's trying to undo, domestic and foreign. Without an actual overarching strategy as to why I'm doing X, Y, and Z. It's if Obama did it, we're going to do the opposite. Even if it's enough to get elected, it's not a positive way to govern the country, to define our nation as to, and the government of policies as to what you are against, rather than saying, here are the challenges we face. And they're real. This is not,
But what was in your response were some specific things you were for, but they are all also the opposite of Donald Trump, right?
So they are, although I'd say, look, the it's a State of the Union response. For the sake of myself, my wife, and everybody else, wasn't going to go on for an hour and 20 minutes on top of an hour and 20 minute speech.
I don't think people would have stayed to
myself either. your time is limited. I can't get into a deep policy analysis on every issue. There is a deal to be made on infrastructure. There is a deal to be made on immigration, should the administration want to engage in one. There was a deal to be made on taxes. They decided not to. There's a deal to be made, I think, on healthcare, if they so choose. There's one of the frustrating realities for me, being the minority member of in the House of Representatives, which obviously is a majority-dominated institution. Republicans don't really need my vote for anything. Fine. But there's the votes for an awful lot of things there that just never get a chance to come up because they get blocked by Republican leadership. I do believe that the country on the whole is on a bell curve politically. There's more folks in the middle than there are the extremes. Right. The extremes are more passionate. They drive the conversation. But it means that if you come up with a reasonable position, you can get the support for it. This administration isn't even trying to get there.
It seems to me that, like, if you look at Obama, right, he was pretty successful as a politician, and his message was hope. There wasn't like a big thought out thing that he stood for. Most people couldn't identify. They knew hope, change you can believe in. I don't know. It wasn't a 14-point plan. Mm-hmm. Does it really come down to that you guys need to find the right messenger, essentially?
Look, I think that's a big part to it. Democrats, myself included, and a lot of people out there, really care about policy. That is ultimately your responsibility once you are in office, is to try to figure out the policies that you want to put forth and govern. And so what I want to hear, and my leaders are, how are you going to address these concerns, healthcare, immigration, climate change, et cetera. And so I want to hear the policies that flesh them out. If this last election was about policy, you had a candidate that was steeped in policy. If it was about policy, Jeb Bush tried to have a policy debate. Marco Rubio tried to have a policy debate. Donald Trump said, my hands are bigger than yours, and won. This was not a policy debate. This was persona.
Democrat, one of your colleagues in Congress said to me, a Democrat, a couple months ago, look, any office except for president, people treat it like a job application. Like, oh, look at your qualifications, various things to play in. But with presidents, always, what do you feel? And Obama didn't get elected because of what he was going to do on healthcare or Iran or whatever else. He got elected because people felt like they believed in him.
Yes.
And it seems like fundamentally, like, that was what was powering Trump. That was what was not powering Hillary Clinton. And fundamentally, that seems to be the problem now, is that you guys, as a party, don't have the ability to get people to kind of believe that you're there.
So I'd agree and then push you on that a bit. I agree wholeheartedly about the characterization of those kind of those candidates and what happened with Senator Obama into President Obama and with President Trump. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why I am not perturbed at all about the prospect of a big, messy primary for Democrats. We need to have the policy. Democrats are really good at finding some smart people that can run some regressions and say, here's what the analysis is on X. We can do that. What you need to do is to match that policy with a message that people can understand and a messenger that has a credibility with the people that we seek to actually persuade to vote for us. I was a very strong supporter of Mrs. Clinton. I think she would have been a great president. I still am a strong supporter of hers. I do believe, however, that if it were a race, and I haven't seen any polls on it, but if it were a race in the last 6 weeks of the election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, I think Joe Biden probably would have been successful.
So do you want him to run?
And I don't think – we'll get there. I don't think there's any
– that was a smile that crept
difference.
Into your face.
I don't think there's – I knew you were going there. I don't think there's actually –
you brought him up.
I don't think there's any real difference between many of the – or most of the policy positions that Mrs. Clinton would take and Joe Biden. Yeah. Vice President Biden has a persona that I think the country is looking for in that moment. That does mean that this is as much about the credibility of a messenger as it is about the message and as it is about the policy. And that means, though, that Democrats need to figure out who can do that. And just because we don't know that at the moment, that's fine. You're a year, 14 months after a stunning election and one that most Democrats thought that Mrs. Clinton was going to win. And so there was going to be a system put in place, and we got to shake that up. And
it seems like any of the potential presidential candidates would take the party in a somewhat different direction in terms of what they would represent.
Great.
Let me ask you the Biden question. You brought him up. Part of the issue with him is that he'd be 79 years old, 78 years old when he was elected, if he was elected. Is that an issue?
So, look, I don't think age is an issue. I'm not going to vote for or against somebody because they're old or young, right? Because of whatever age
they
are.
But the idea of like the party going back versus having a fresh start.
I think what the party needs to do is to have a competitive primary, which I expect we're going to have.
Yeah.
And have these candidates fight it out and debate it out and actually see who has their thumb on the pulse of the American public to actually say, we're trying to find our way through here and consolidate it. Look, this is what happened a year ago, 2 years ago with Donald Trump's election. It was a 17-person field. Most folks, myself included, thought that Donald Trump didn't stand a chance and that it would flesh out between an establishment candidate and an anti-establishment candidate and that it was going to consolidate around an establishment candidate, as most Republican races had. I was wrong. The president, to give him credit, had his finger on the pulse of something that most people didn't see or feel. Democrats need to do that too. And could it be one of those names that we know at the moment? Yeah, absolutely. Could it be somebody we don't know at the moment? Yeah,
sure. I mean, it's not going to be somebody we don't know. It may be somebody who's
Not well known. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So is that a yes or no on you wanting Joe Biden to run?
I want everybody to run. Jump on in.
Are you sensitive to the concerns that people have that Elizabeth Warren, your old professor, would bring the party in too liberal of a direction?
No. I know Senator Warren, obviously, on a personal level. I think she's fantastic. I'm a big supporter of hers, and I have a strong affinity for her. I don't know if she wants to run for president. I don't know if she's going to run for president.
There's a lot of Democrats who are concerned about it.
I think in very short order, she's become an extraordinary force for the Democratic Party. I know from sitting in her classrooms how a number of the folks feel when they're getting grilled by her in a Senate committee hearing room. It's not exactly a pleasant place to be. But I can tell you that the American public is better off for her asking those tough questions and getting demanding answers from folks that otherwise would try to wriggle off the hook. And so at a time when we're sitting there saying, hey, government's not being held accountable, is there a reason why we would want somebody that knows how to hold government accountable? Absolutely. So look, I think, should she try to run or should she seek to run? I think she would be a great president. I think she'd do a great job. I do think that this is one where whoever thinks that they have the policies, a narrative, a reason that can try to unify not just the party, but a country behind a message that is not, yes, Isaac, obviously, by definition in these times, part of it is going to be against the incumbent. That's always the case, right? There's going to be a strong anti-Trump message to that. But it can't just be, he did this, so I did that.
I mean, it takes me a week before the election, not even a week, the Thursday before the election, one of Hillary Clinton's top people said to me, we knew this was going to be a change election. And we realized she could never be the change candidate. So we tried to change the question. They thought that they were successful at it. Obviously, they weren't. But it seems like Hillary Clinton was never going to be that person. So it is going to be person dependent, it feels like.
Absolutely. No, I do. I would agree with you. And so that's where
you guys can put together the best message of what the Democratic Party stands for. And it doesn't,
you know, I could go give one of President Obama's speeches. It's not going to land as if it were President Obama giving it. Nobody else is going to be able to do that, right? Why? Because it's his speech. Clearly, of course, the persona matters and the credibility around that persona, the values that that person holds, how they resonate with the public. And look, we've seen, in my mind, the kind of the highs and lows with that. I think President Trump, who has done a very disciplined job of branding himself a certain way, be able to maintain a level of credibility with folks that I don't think he's actually representing all that well. That being said, he has tried to brand this tax cut as a middle-class tax cut.
No,
it's not a middle-class tax cut. Will the middle class get some tax cut out of it? Yeah, they're going to get some part of it. By any independent economic analysis, is the heart of that tax cut dedicated towards the middle class? No, it's not.
As I was heading up to the speech, there was an article that I saw that said Joe Kennedy has a pot problem. And I actually don't want to get into the specifics of marijuana legalization, but there were members of your party who were saying that you were the wrong choice to be the official Democratic response because of your position on marijuana legalization. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that kind of tell you everything you need to know about where the Democratic Party is right now?
look, I think it's a... look, that's a tough issue for me. I come at it a little bit differently, obviously, than the vast majority of my colleagues. I hear their position. I really do. I'm in a state that voted for it, too.
You could not be the representative of the Democratic Party because of your position on marijuana legalization.
And
in the minds of...
Yeah.
In the minds it's like purity test, the stuff that people are so worried about, and there it is.
Look, as a politician, right? Somebody that gets a whole bunch of issues thrown at them every day. I try to do my best to do the homework and learn up on those issues best I can. I'll take a position on ones that I think is right and defensible. People will disagree with it. Fine. That's the nature of the beast. I'm not a huge fan of litmus tests just because I think we've got a broad series of issues. You might agree with somebody on one thing that doesn't necessarily disqualify them on something else. That being said, that's not for me to say. If somebody feels really passionately about an issue, that's for them to decide whether you're in or you're out, right? And that's their decision. I think the party is clearly moving in that legalization direction. It might already be there. I've got some reservations because of some of the details. It's about, I think, process matters and the consumer protections on this matter. And it's a little bit more complicated than
but
just...
But if Democrats can't get over that kind of issue raising, isn't that... I mean, we did one of these with Tony Perkins a couple of weeks ago. And there's an evangelical leader who you'd think that his position on things would be very clear. And he said that because President Trump is where he wants him to be on most of the policy issues, he gives him a mulligan for maybe having an affair with
this story.
Everybody should read it and listen, and you can get the old episode in our archives. But, you know, that seems to be the way that a lot of Republicans are looking at this and saying, like, yeah, we're getting enough, so we're going to ignore some of it. It just seems weird to think how the Democratic Party is going to be successful if on all these little things you're sort of pulling apart.
And look, this is an important issue for folks, and they have every right and should be passionate about it and organize on it and do what they need to do to advance their position. And I totally respect that and I encourage it. That being said, this is, I think, one of those issues that is going to come up over the course of a campaign where if it's really important to the Democratic Party as a policy portfolio that, yes, our nominee should then adopt that position. But candidates out there should also be able to put forth other ideas, not just on this issue, but a bunch of others. If your position doesn't quite line up then, I mean, this turns down to electoral math, right? Get other people there that are willing to let you take a pass on that one and go out there and vote for you anyway. I just think that a lot of this still is in flux. That's an issue where, again, the Democratic Party is certainly moving in a more progressive position on it. I think there's some safeguards there that we need to make sure we get right if that's the direction that Democrats want to go. But I'm not worried about the overall policy position. I'm not worried about the overall purity tests and litmus tests. I don't think the vast majority of the American electorate thinks that way. And quite candidly, I think the vast majority of folks don't eat, sleep, and breathe politics, right? They're busy out there trying to make ends meet and care for their kids and, you know, worry about how you're going to make your mortgage and if you can get a vacation and, you know, what's going on with your kids at school and the rest of it. And so politics to them is an afterthought. And when folks, you know, when those folks tune in the last 6 weeks before an election or 2 months or whatever else it might be, yeah, they might start asking questions on the top issues that they think about. I do think that, and this comes back to a little bit of what you said before, how I think about it anyway, and I'm not sure this is right, but I think most people understand that, particularly for the presidency, that that's a really hard job and that no one can really fathom the responsibilities of it or the challenge that you have when you're there. They just want to know that when you're faced with a choice that has no good answer, because those are basically the choices the president has to make. If it's an easy one, somebody else should have done it, right? It's only the ones.
That's what Obama used to always say. If somebody could have solved it before him, it would have been solved.
They should have, right? They, if you orchestrate your administration, right?
That was just like the way that he would describe the presidency, right? Correct or not.
And I would tend to, from not being there, I would tend to agree with him, right? You're choosing between least bad options with not a whole lot of information. So that being said, I believe folks are kind of asking of the president, of their candidate, when you're in that position, will you remember people like me? Will you remember people that have the values and the concerns that I do? Or am I going to be the one that gets bargained away? And I think that comes down to a lot of that persona piece that we were talking about before. And so I don't think there's a whole lot, I haven't seen polls on this, but I don't think that there's a whole lot of Americans that end up being single issue voters and say it's just this or nothing else. And again, that's their choice if they want to, but we got to put forth another vision.
Let's talk about you for a minute. You were picked in part because of your last name, right?
Probably.
What is that like to have that be what people associate you with? Like, you come in, there are benefits and detriments to that, right? You were born with that last name. You've never had another last name.
That's true. I mean, look, I think, you know, a couple of things. One, and obviously the easy one, is I'm incredibly proud of it. I'm proud of the contributions that other family members have made, whether that's been elective office or otherwise. And I think there's a lot to be proud of, and I am. Two, you know, look, a lot of folks, when they think of my last name and they think of a Kennedy family, they focus far more on Kennedy than they do on family, right? And I try to focus far more on family than I do on Kennedy. I have been extraordinarily fortunate to have members of my family that have served our country and I believe served with distinction and made a contribution. They were also parents, grandparents. They were uncles. They were brothers. They were sisters. Or dads and moms. And, you know, when those stories get shared around a dinner table or barbecue over the summer or whatnot, to your point earlier, it's not what were your policy positions, right? It's more the likes of people.
Is it weird that when you were sitting in history class, though, and being like, oh, okay, well, that's my grandfather?
yeah, I mean, it's obviously a bit different, you know, and you realize, and certainly in this position, you realize that my family means different things to different people. And there's going to be some people that are inspired by the contributions that my family members have made and to an extent apply that lens to me, which on the one hand is a blessing. On the other hand, you know, when you're going to give a speech and you're getting compared to President Kennedy or Senator Edward Kennedy or my grandfather, Robert Kennedy, they set the bar pretty high on how to deliver a speech. So yikes. That's also an honor, right? There's going to be other folks that kind of shut you out of that conversation because of that.
And it feels like when you guys were kids, like there were like speech trainings for all the cousins.
No, football lessons, right? Look, it's just what I remember about growing up as part of that family, again, a family that's seen its fair share of successes and challenges, is that there are very few constants you can count on in life. And one of them is family. They'll be there for the good times. They will be there for the challenging ones and the heartbreaks too. And that always comes first. And that part isn't always the stuff that gets written about in history books. That's not what you learned in history class. You learned their policy positions or what happened on, you know, locations and dates, you don't really learn about values. You don't learn about what they're like around the dinner table. And that's the important stuff for me.
Where do you fit into where things go from here? You pass on a governor's race. Some of your colleagues say to me that they want you to run for minority leader if you get your way, majority leader. Do you have any interest in doing that?
That's not on the radar at the moment. It just isn't for a variety of reasons. First and foremost is that I've got a 2-year-old and a 5-week-old, 6-week-old as of today. And I'm away a lot, as is. Family is based up in Massachusetts. And this job is an extraordinary honor and one that I take very, very seriously. And I try to take my responsibilities as a member of Congress seriously. It also happens to put a pretty considerable burden on a young family. And I want to make sure that I get to see my kids as much as I can and be there for my family as much as I can.
What would it take to get you to do something? What would it take if some say, oh, Joe, we really want you to run for president in 2020, you know, that or whatever, 2024. Is there something that you would feel like, okay, that's it?
I don't see that happening. I just don't. You know,
someone said to me, the Oprah Winfrey Joe Kennedy ticket.
That's right. That might do it, right? That might do it. Oprah's, if I could sail in as Oprah's VP. So Oprah, if you're listening, go for it. Right? Short of that, I'm not holding my breath.
Do you worry about there being a narrowing political potency to the Kennedy name just because, you know, people who were 10 years old when JFK was inaugurated are a lot older now?
They are. I realize this. Some folks might not believe me in this. I didn't run for Congress on the hopes that one day you're going to run for something else. I think that if you wanted to do that, you could make a pretty good argument that the way to protect yourself from a political record is not to run for office in your early 30s and amass a whole bunch of tough votes so you get asked about your position on pot, right?
And get to be in the minority in the House.
And get to be in the minority in the House, right? I think that for all its imperfections and its struggles, government's important. And I'd like to think I have a contribution to make to that. I take that responsibility seriously. And I want to keep doing it. I'm in an odd profession in which that the moment you win one seat, people want to know when you're running for something else. I'm in no hurry with that. I've got a very full life. I've sleep deprived enough as is. If opportunities come up, of course, I'll evaluate them and try to make sure they're the right ones for me and my family. And if I think I can do that job and do those responsibilities the right way, I don't feel any pressure at all from anybody to be pushed in a position to jump at something that I don't think I can do right and do well. And the bottom line, you know, on those issues with some of those leadership races is, look, I have an inside view of the talent in our caucus. There's some really talented people in our caucus. They're starting to find ways to make their contributions and elevate their own profiles. Our caucus is going to be fine. The leadership is there. It's there currently, and there's a next generation of leadership that's there. The caucus doesn't need anybody so much that they need to cut a deal to say, hey, we need you to be our leader. They don't need to do that. They certainly don't need to do that for me. And there's other people there that I think are going to do a really great job at it. And I think that's a strength that we have. And so, you know, I'd like to think I'm in an enviable position where I get to do a job that I very much enjoy, a responsibility that I take seriously, try to spend as much time as I can also with a very young family. And when opportunities come up, we'll evaluate them. But I'm not in a rush.
All right. So nobody should start printing those buttons quite yet.
No.
All right. Congressman Joe Kennedy, thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Does that sound like a person is running for president one day? One day soon? You tell me. Thanks as always to Zach Stanton for producing and joining me on our Newton adventure. Remember to subscribe so you can get all the episodes coming up. New Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and many more. And please remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts or however you're listening. Catch up on that Tony Perkins interview Kennedy and I were talking about if you haven't heard it yet. And catch you next time on Off Message.